Well, I'm delighted to see you all here. Thank you, Sarah, for the more than generous introduction. It's been really 2 decades since I used to lecture in this room quite regularly. And from the show of hands to some of the people who are here now, who have been members of my cabinet, and now you're here by preference, and I'm very flattered. The collection of manuscripts and letters of James Joyce at Cornell has no equal, especially in its relevance to the formative stages of Joyce's literary career up to 1920. Now, how did it come to rest here in rural upstate New York at what Francis Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, described when she was teaching at Cornell as a centrally inaccessible location? The story is one of chance, of coincidence, and of the confluence of improbable circumstances. And since I played a role, though a minor one, in the cast of characters, I can tell that story as a first-person narrative. It all began almost exactly a half century ago, on a pleasant afternoon in the autumn of 1956. I was sitting in my office on the main floor of Goldman Smith, trying to persuade myself I should be doing something useful, when the telephone rang. The caller was Mario Einaudi, a professor in the Department of Government. Did I know anything about James Joyce? Ever responded. I know that Joyce was an author who, in the words of Richard Ellman, his biographer, set both the English language and literature on its end, and that he, together with Marcel Proust, was the most innovative and influential novelist of the century. Mario then said that an acquaintance of his from Trieste, named Otto Caro Weiss, a lawyer with offices both in Italy and in New York City, had gotten in touch with him. This had been entrusted by Nellie Joyce, the widow of James Joyce's younger brother Stanislaus, to find a buyer for some literary materials and correspondence of James Joyce, which she had inherited from her husband. And now they have an inventory of the manuscripts. Would I care to see it? Indeed I would. He hurried over and put on my desk a pile of blue-lined yellow pages inscribed with a list of items that made my eyes dazzle. The list included a schoolboy essay by Joyce, manuscripts of early poems published later, of stories that were later included, that were included in Joyce's doubleters, written materials for Joyce's portrait of Artist as a Young Man, and fragments of his great novel, Ulysses. And perhaps most important, it included 1,000 or so early letters from and to Joyce, many of them intimate and revealing family letters, others rather copious correspondence with some of the most eminent writers of the day, such as Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, William Butler Yeats, Oliver Gogarty, and others. How much, I asked Mario, a little breathlessly, did Weiss want for these documents? He had given Mario to understand that they could be bought for $30,000. I need here to digress. The first unlikely chance in a series of happy accidents is that the late Mario Einaudi should be at all at remote and rural Ithaca. He was a thoroughly cosmopolitan European, member of a well-to-do family in the Italian intellectual aristocracy, whose father, Luigi, a distinguished economist, was elected the first president of the Italian Republic after the Second World War. Mario was himself an eminent, thoroughly liberal scholar of political theory and history, who, in the parlance of Mussolini's dictatorship, had left Italy in 1933 to teach first at Harvard, then at Fordham, and in 1945, finally, permanently and happily, at Cornell. As for the man with the engaging name of Ottokar Weiss, in his youth in Trieste, he had been a friend of James Joyce, and through James also of Stanislaus. James is admiring, but critical, often disapproving, and always long-suffering younger brother, who had been persuaded by his brother to join him and Nora, with whom he had eloped, in Trieste. Since James was himself a restless wanderer, moving from Dublin to Pola, to Rome, to Trieste, to Zurich, to Paris, and also sometimes by necessity, sometimes by choice, moving from one house to another within each city, James fell into the habit of depositing his written materials for safekeeping with his stable brother, until, that is, their relations cooled in about 1920. Many of these early manuscripts were still in Stanislaus's house in Trieste when James died in 1941. They had descended to Stanislaus' widow, Nellie, who happened to know and appeal to Ottokar Weiss to find a buyer for them, who in turn happened to remember that Mario Einaudi, whom he knew, was at Cornell and had then sent to Mario the list that was now on my desktop here in Goldsmith Hall, not far down the main corridor. With that list in one of my hands and Mario's elbow in the other, I hurried to the office of the director of the Cornell Library System, Stephen McCarthy, who at that time had an office in the old Tower Library. He had once recognized the golden opportunity, and while Einaudi and I were still in his office, telephoned the president of Cornell, Dean Malott. Now, both McCarthy and Malott happened to be just the right men to play essential parts in acquiring the Joyce manuscript, and I must digress again to explain why. And that explanation, in turn, requires a cursory glance at the remarkable history of the Cornell Library and of its special collections. It was Cornell's immense good fortune to have as its co-founder and first president, Andrew D. White, a man who fervently believed, and it was a belief not common at that time, that one cannot have a great university without a great research library. And he, with his in his usual mode of grandiose ideation, set out to establish at newly founded Cornell the finest research library in the country, as he put it. But he came remarkably close to achieving that impossible dream. While what was himself one of the leading, maybe the leading, collector of scholarly books in his era, and he gave to Cornell his almost unparalleled accumulations gathered for his own wide scholarly uses in such areas as Martin Luther and the Reformation, witchcraft and the Inquisition, the French Revolution, and the history of science, and other things too. He very wisely appointed as the first Cornell librarian his friend Willard Fisk, who inherited from his wife, Jenny McGraw, the money that enabled him to gather, finally to leave the Cornell, his almost peerless collections in Dante, Petrarch, and Icelandic literature. White also established the principle and made it part of the library's ethos, or as we would now put it, the library's culture, to purchase, whenever possible, existing specialized libraries collected, gathered together by individual scholars for their own uses in Europe and America. Now, astonishingly, for example, A.D. White arranged for Cornell to buy the Anton Collection in Classical Philology and Literature, then the finest of its sort in America, before Cornell was even founded, that is, while he was waiting for the first campus building to be built. The result was that by the 1890s, Cornell was established in 1868, of course. By the 1890s, when the first library building, the Tower Library, was finally erected, Cornell's holdings were ranked fifth among all the university libraries in the country. That was Remember, Cornell was then only 30 years old, while three of the four libraries ranked above Cornell's, that of those of Harvard, Yale, Columbia, had been founded before or during the 18th century, and had been collecting books ever since. But alas, although Cornell continued to acquire great collections of books, mainly through the generosity of its alumni, whom I needn't tell you constitute a special group who are loyal just this side of it, Madison. While the special collections accumulated, the support for the daily staffing operation and acquisitions in the new library became increasingly inadequate. The Tower Library, which was the finest research structure in the country when it was built in 1891, and which at first had what seemed at that time generous space for later accumulation, very quickly became overcrowded. The library suffered from its own success. And in the period between the two world wars, especially during the Great Depression after 1929, the status of the library spiraled downward. To make room for new acquisitions, books were shuffled around, crowded into obscure corners, hidden in closets, even under staircases in the library. I was there and I saw it. Until the scene when I arrived in 1945 was more like the setting for a story by Kafka than a major research library. The alumna, one alumna, Rita Gerlach, wrote a fine essay on the history of the library in which she quoted a librarian from another university who, in an address to a library conference in 1946, said publicly, "If you want to see how a great university has systematically killed its library, go to Cornell." That was a very sad period after its glorious start under quiet. But all that changed drastically and permanently with the appointment of Stephen McCarthy as head of the Cornell Library that same year in 1946. He was promised full support by the administration, reorganized the library system, made brilliant new appointments in key positions, and instilled new optimism into depleted and dispirited library staff. And perhaps most important was the fact that soon after McCarthy's arrival, Cornell in 1951 acquired as president Dean W. Malott. Now, on the surface, President Malott seems an unlikely candidate for resuscitating the Cornell Library when, following the death of the tenure of A.D. White, all the earlier presidents have failed to do so. For all these presidents had been scholars, while Malott was primarily a student. He had a master's degree from the Harvard Business School, became a vice president of the Hawaiian Pineapple Company, then returned to the Harvard Business School as an associate professor before coming to Cornell, but first to Kansas and then to Cornell as president. But Dean Malott has many powerful qualities required for university presidents. We do, as he himself says, that a university is not a business, I'm quoting. University is not a business. We are not efficient and never will be. He knew also when and how to rely on the expertise of others where his own fell short. And he was, importantly, decisive. He knew how to calculate odds and had the audacity to take risks when circumstances called for and justified. During his tenure, he transformed the federal campus. And among his many academic initiatives, two especially stand out as eminently humanistic. He established the Museum of Fine Arts, first in the A.D. White building, then in the wonderful sculpturesque museum building designed by I.M. Tay and underwritten at Malott's urging by Herbert F. Johnson. And he poured new funds into the library system And after almost 50 years of increasing inadequacy of the original Tower Library, he got Cornell a new library building, the Olin Library. I wanted to stop again to tell you a couple of stories about the lot at the library. The lot was quickly assured that the library was inadequate, that we needed a new building. And he got Frosty Hill, who was then, I think, the provost, to investigate the situation for him. Frosty came to the lot and said, the library is in a terrible condition and needs to be turned around. The lot said, what would it take to begin the process? Frosty says, I'm sorry to tell you, it will take immediately doubling the library budget. Then said the lot, double it. I once asked the lot, long after he'd retired, if the story was true. And he said, in his usual way, approximately. what we do know is that the library budget sextupled during his tenure. Now I have a second story. I happened to be a member of the Faculty Library Committee when President Malott attended a meeting at which he asked us to confirm his judgment that to ensure a central location for the new library that he was then planning, it had to be built in place of Boardman Hall. Now, Boardman Hall, as some of you may remember, we approved of that plan. He persuaded us it was the only way to get a new library. The only other plan that made any sense called for encapsulating the old Tower Library in a new building that would run on down the library slope. And both the old library and the slope were sacrosanct. That plan didn't have a chance. And we voted to tear down Boardman Hall, and all hell broke loose. The Boardman Hall had been built by Henry W. Miller, the first great Cornell architect, who had also designed and built the Tower Library. It was beautiful with its Romanesque architecture, spacious offices, gabled red tile roof, but alas, it was antiquated, it was inefficient, and a hopeless fire trap. I can tell you because I gave a course there, and the superintendent took me down and showed me that the heating system was a hot air furnace and a huge fan blew hot air through all the cracks in the floor. So any lighted match, the whole thing would explode. Boardman was a precious building for Cornell, and it was lovely. And the issue was on campus and in the national press, too. But President Malott, against all opposition, stood staunch. And I remember vividly when, after all the verbal wars, the day finally arrived to tear down, in the spring of 1959, to tear down old Boardman and begin the new Olin Library. The comment made by a cartoon that appeared in the Sun, Cornell Sun, that morning. It's a perfect example of sardonic undergraduate humor. It showed the space behind then Boardman Hall and the Sage Hall. In the background was the silhouette of Day Hall, which was then quite a new administration, the first new built after the Second World War. That is driven in with one of those terrifying looking wrecking balls hanging down to a chain. And he's leaning out of the cab and he's asking an obvious undergraduate directions. And the undergraduate is wordlessly pointing at Day Hall. Remember the scene in which Mario and I, and Inari and I were sitting in McCarthy's office, in the list of the manuscripts in the Joyce collection. McCarthy, surprised by what he saw, immediately called up President Malott. Now you'd think that Malott wouldn't care, would be opposed. Malott was a rather proper man, and it worried him with the nature of Joyce's writings. he rose to the occasion. He said, "In your judgment, Stephen, is the purchase worthwhile?" McCarthy replied, "I think it's a lifetime." Malott's reply was characteristic, then vile. "But where will we get the money?" Malott, "You get the collection. Raising the money is my business." Now, some of Malott's other virtues as the university president were that he knew which of Cornell's faithful alumni not only had the funds, but the special interest and the generosity to underwrite this project. He also knew how to reason and cajole the alumni into doing so. In this instance, he appealed to several possible donors, but especially to William G. Menon, class of 1908. And here we come to the last of the cast of donors in this story. Again, on the face of it, William Menon, who had prospered as a manufacturer in Morristown, New Jersey, and other men's toiletries, seems an improbable person to acquire for Cornell a collection of James Joyce, who is, for much of the reading public at the time, was still thought of as the author of a work bordering on pornography. But Menon was a man of literary interest who bought and collected rare books and had already given the Cornell Library two magnificent gifts, an almost priceless set of the first four folio editions of the works of William Shakespeare and the collection of the first editions of Charles Dickens, especially his serial publications in which many of his novels first appeared. I must just digress once again to tell the story that Steve McCarthy told me about his first meeting with William Menon. One day he was sitting in the old Tower Library when a small man appeared carrying a big part wrapped in brown paper tied with string. And he said, I think, are you interested in books, in collecting books? And Steve said, yes, the librarian. He was. I've got some old books here that I don't need anymore, and I thought, I wondered whether you'd be interested in them. And Steve said politely, because this happened quite often, he said, by alumni who collected third-rate novelists, grandfathers that had been before them. And Steve said, oh, thank you very much, and then this man had departed. Steve didn't think of opening the parcel until he was ready to go home that evening. He cut the cords, unwrapped the paper, and there were all the first Shakespeare folios. It's impossible to collect now, I would say, all of them. Now, how did Menon come to collect such excessively rare books? I can only repeat you the account Menon himself, when we played to at a banquet, a small banquet, to celebrate the acquisition of the Joyce collection in 1957. Now, I suspect that Menon's account, which he gave us then at that dinner, reveals much more about his own wry, self-deprecating humor than it does about the facts. But here's the story. He said that Menon told us he had well-to-do friends living in his neighborhood who were collectors. One collected old automobiles, and another collected old paintings. And they always showed Menon their collections with pride when he went to see them. And so finally decided he ordered something. And he went to his lawyer, who was knowledgeable, he thought, and said, what shall I collect? That doesn't take up much room. I don't have space for the law. And the lawyer said, why don't you collect old books? And I thought that was a good idea. And he collected old books. before he knew he had this pregnant, and decided that he came to, he decided, the books took up so much space that finally he had to build a room to hold them. And then his lawyer saw these books and said, "Menon, you paid so much money for these books, they're very valuable. You've got to insure them." So he said, "I went to an insurance company and I said, I'd like to insure my own books." And they said, "I'm going to appraise them." And they said, "You can't insure these books unless you keep them in the vault." "Where are the books?" "They filled it in your basement." He says, "Well, here I have all these books to show to my friends." "In the basement, I can't say after dinner, would you like to come?" "I'm going to give them to Cornell." Well, to relieve any suspense that I feel, given that William Bennin did provide us with the $30,000 for buying the Joyce manuscripts, for an additional $6,000, we bought from Nellie Joyce what she had reserved from the original sale, the extraordinary exchange of highly charged love letters between James and Nora Joyce. William Menon later added $7,000 to buy other writings by Joyce that Nellie Joyce turned up, stashed away in trunk and attic. And finally, Cornell was able to complement its manuscript holdings by searching for and finding a ready-made collection of the publications in periodicals and books of all of Joyce's works. And one last happy coincidence. It turned out that the collector of that group of things was James Sperry. James Sperry was a Chicago lawyer and a Cornell alumnus, a graduate of the Cornell Law School. He agreed to sell his collection to Cornell in 1961 for only $2,250. And who do you suppose provided that money? You guessed it, William G. Menon. Now, I have been specific at dollar cost for a reason. The initial purchase of Joyce materials by Menon cost $30,000. The additional letters and manuscripts bought from Nellie Joyce came to a total of $13,000. The question that must have occurred to many of you is, these seem modest sums. Why all the fuss and difficulty about raising the money for them? The partial answer, of course, is that the value of the dollar 50 years ago was very much higher than it is now. The distinguished Cornell economist Fred Kahn tells me that it was approximately 7 times higher. So that Menon's $30,000 would come to say $210,000 now. Much more important, however, was that in the 1950s, 20th century literary writings were not yet avidly sought after. And so they weren't bid up to the phenomenal heights by a multitude of collectors the way they are now. Also, James Joyce was very far from having achieved for the common reader his present towering reputation as one of the great figures in English letters. In 1924, for example, the collector John Quinn, who had received the total manuscript of Ulysses from Joyce, put it up for auction. It fetched $1,975. As for the materials offered to Cornell by Adhikara Weiss, Dick Ellman told me, the great Joyce biographer, that Dick Ellman told me that he had discovered this cache in the possession of Nellie Joyce, and he had urged North and he had used it to write the whole first part of this great biography of Joyce, without it being quite helpful. But he had urged Northwestern University, where he was, to buy it, but they had simply refused. Captain Reagan has recently discovered in the Cornell archives a letter indicating that Otto Weiss had offered the collection before he'd offered it to Cornell to the University of Kansas, which had already accumulated from Joyce material. They had made a counter offer of $10,000 only for the letters, and for the complete collection, $40,000. It was that he had thought of before himself of his friend Einaudi and turned to Cornell. The literary market, needless to say, has changed dramatically since that time. While Joyce's manuscripts and correspondence are more highly prized, it's safe to say, than those of any other English writer, in English. Are there any indications of what the Menon collection of Joyce papers might fetch, the one we have here? No. I can't help being curious about it. I put the question to Catherine Reagan, curator at Cornell, and she being omniscient on all such matters, was ready with an answer. In some sale of Sotheby's a few years ago, the notebook in which Joyce laboriously composed a segment of Ulysses called Circe fetched $1,400,000. Now the Cornell collection has two equivalent batches of Ulysses. One segment Nausicaa, the other for Oxen and the Sun. So they're worth something like $3 million, just this tiny segment of the total collection. Even more startling is the amount paid for a single letter from Joyce to Nora, who became his wife. 5 years after he eloped with Nora Barnacle, Joyce, then in his latter 20s, had to pay an extended visit to Dublin, leaving Nora and his two children in Trieste. Among the letters he wrote to Nora at that time are a number which express an extraordinary melange of moods, alternating between expressions of a deep and tender, and indeed almost religious, love, with wild passages of erotic memories, desires, and fantasies, of a frankness, an anatomical detail, and a blunt idiom beyond anything even in the once notorious passages in the once banned novel, Ulysses. Last year, 2004, Stray Letter from that exchange with Nora turned up at Christie's. It fetched $445,000. Now, the Cornell collection, if you want, you can go over and read these letters yourself. The Cornell collection has dozens of such letters to Nora, permanently love letters to Nora. Articulate what they and the many hundreds of other letters written by Joyce, together with the mass of all the literary manuscripts we have, would sell for, newly discovered and put on the auction block now, requires an exercise in the higher mathematics. Well, that concludes my story of the unlikely chain of the people and events that made it possible for Catherine Reagan to put together, for your delectation, an exhibition of manuscripts, letters, and memorabilia of James Joyce, now deep in the bowels of the remarkable underground library with special collections and rare books funded by Carl Kruk. You are all cordially invited to examine that exhibition just next door, and also to attend in that same place, and immediately after this lecture, a reception which is designed to memorialize the Joyce collection, but above all, to celebrate that bizarre, that infuriating, or irresistibly engaging genius, James Joyce himself. Thank you very much.
But irresistibly engaging genius. Definitely.